Welcome back to hour number two of today's edition of the Truth Jihad radio show that's now happening every weekend, 2 to 4 p.m., right here on We the People Radio Network. Well, after that great hour with David Ray Griffin, I'm pleased to bring on another exceptional guest and another exceptional interview. It's Jay Kolar, a contributor to the Hidden History of 9/11, and indeed the author of the lead essay in that volume. It's called What We Now Know About the Alleged 9/11 Hijackers. What do we now know? Well, as David Ray Griffin says in his lecture, 9/11 and Nationalist Faith, one thing that we do know for sure now is that 9/11 was not orchestrated or even assisted by devout Muslims. And yet, the 9/11 myth continues to generate murderous, perhaps even genocidal, Islamophobia all over the world, and Barack Obama will be using it to invade Pakistan, launch another illegal war of aggression over there, or at least it sure sounds like he will, judging from what he's been saying. How are we ever going to put this horrible genocidal myth to bed? Well, one way, of course, is to go after the facts and report the facts carefully, and that is what Jay Kolar has done in this stunning article about the 9/11 hijackers. I believe it's Jay's first appearance on Patriot Radio, so it's a real honor to welcome Jay Kolar to Truth Jihad Radio. Welcome, Jay. How are you?
Hi, Kevin. Fine, thank you, and thank you for having me on.
Well, it's great to have you. You know, I've actually wanted to have you as a radio guest for quite some time now, and I'm glad it's finally happened. So, you know, your article is really a terrific resource. I think the best single volume or single article treatment of the subject. What got you on the trail of writing it, and you know, what's been the reaction from it?
Well, I suppose, like everybody else, I saw the videos and of 9/11, and I just couldn't believe that it actually happened as they said it happened. And then I contacted a professor I've got his name now, in Northern Arizona State University, and he was looking for people to professors, basically, to write articles. And I suggested a few, and then he put me on their list, and I was emailing back and forth, and I ended up, even though I'm not a professor, I ended up getting interested and suggested that if nobody else wanted to, I'd do the chapter on the hijackers. And that was basically how it happened.
A dirty job, but somebody has to do it. Well, you know, that's right. Why I'm doing 9/11 truth activism, and that's why I'm running for Congress as the peace and truth candidate here in Wisconsin. Sometimes everybody else sort of volunteers you by, you know, they all take one step backwards and you're left there kind of, oh, okay.
Exactly.
So, yeah, your article is really quite wonderful, and I think it's even many people in the 9/11 truth movement don't realize just how ridiculously weak and counterfactual is the government's case against these alleged 19 hijackers. Where would you start in pointing out just, you know, how bad this case is?
I hesitate to start just anywhere, but just about anywhere is where you could start. The government's, I always start with what the government's case was, and basically it was built up by the FBI, and as we now know, FBI Director Mueller has admitted that his case against those 19 FBI-named hijackers would never stand up in a court of law. But despite that, the FBI has refused to alter its list except for there was an earlier list, and that earlier list contained four different names from the people who were on Flight 11 than the final list. And a lot of people don't know about it because it just it wasn't reported like a lot of things that the media missed. Do you want me to get into that or mention their
names? Yeah, sure. You know, David Griffin actually brought that up a little bit at the tail end of our interview. He mentioned the Buhari brothers were originally the ones who had supposedly gone up to Portland, and then it turned out that they were, well, one was still alive and the other one had died a year earlier.
Yes, their identification was found in the car that was later it was all transformed into evidence against Atta and El Omari when these guys started showing up alive. Actually, the two of them, the Bukhari brothers, they were called by many. In fact, Adnan Bukhari's lawyer called them brothers, And yet Adnan himself disagreed with his own lawyer. He said that, no, we're not even related.
Well, and, I've been mad at my brother once or twice, but I don't know if I'd go back.
Well, but in actual fact, we still don't know whether we're related or not, but I found two excellent photographs of them, which shows that they look remarkably similar. The Amir Bukhari, who, by the way, died on September 11th, coincidentally, of 2000, 1 year to the day before the attack. He has this, he's shown in this picture sunning himself on the beach, I guess, or at a pool, and he has a military-style haircut, you know, completely shaved almost, very like a crew cut, and long sideburns, and which are pencil-thin, and a pencil-thin beard, and a pencil-thin mustache. Similarly, I guess after, a while after that, this photo is taken of Adnan Bukhari, who has the exact same style of haircut, beard, you know, everything's pencil thin. And his crew cut seems to have grown in more, though. So it makes me suspicious that if these guys weren't brothers, you know, maybe they were both in the military.
Right, had the same barber, at least.
Yeah, or had the same barber. Well, it gets really complicated when you find out that Bukhari Admir died on his maiden flight, ironically, for this Flight Safety Academy.
Right.
For whom many of these guys had, the ones that were sent over to take flying lessons, who later became called hijackers. They were hijackers. Pardon me?
It's a little irony that you almost just couldn't make up, right? You know, dying 1 year to the day before 9/11, flying in
exactly.
His maiden flight for the Flight Safety Academy. I mean, you know, that'd be rejected by Hollywood. It's too improbable.
Really. I mean, no matter how gruesome this story is, there's always a few little really strange pieces of humor that you could make up. The guy, Amir Bukhari, even though that was his maiden voyage, they said it was a Piper Cub airplane, which is, you know, similar to everybody else that trained. They trained in Pipers and in Cessnas. And,
well, that's great training for flying 767s.
Right. It's quite a jump. they couldn't fly those planes, most of them. But actually, Amir had the one that died a year before 9/11. He actually had a pilot's license from the Philippines. So he was a certified pilot.
Interesting. You know, I understand Ada actually had a certification, too, that was higher than the lessons he was allegedly taking in Florida.
Right. So they were basically all these guys were going through the motions, some of whom had no flight experience, and no matter how much flight experience you could give to somebody like Hani Hashur's, he couldn't fly. And he kept moving around from flight school to flight school, from Phoenix to Etrieb, and then to San Diego, and he ended up in New York State. And they saw that he had a pilot's license, but then they wanted to check him out before they gave him the plane to lease, and sure enough, he couldn't fly, so they wouldn't even give him the plane. Then you have, well, Amir's brother, Adnan, is very, very strange, too, because after Amir dies, Adnan promptly starts training with the same Flight Safety Academy, you know? Mm. And they both lived at the same house, by the way, the same address in Vero Beach, Florida. And their neighbors were the other two guys, Abdul Rahman Alamari and another guy named Amir Kamfar, none of whom made the FBI's final list. And then, well, actually, the FBI replaced them with four other hijacker names, which stuck to the final, even though they, too, appeared, they would pop up alive, such as Abdul Aziz Alamari, who was Abdul Rahman Alamari's replacement. So
where did he pop up alive?
Pardon me?
You said he popped up alive?
Yeah, he pops up alive also. Where? Good question. Somewhere in Saudi Arabia. And, you know, now he's a protected, I guess you could say, protected witness. Saudi Arabia, as you know, having delved into the, you know, done your own exploits of trying to find Walid al-Sheri, they're a very closed country. it's a kingdom. Whatever the king says goes, and you know the entire Ministry of Information is run as a very close society as well. So whatever the king says goes, and it would be very easy to hide all these guys in Saudi Arabia.
And that is the best hypothesis, is that most or all of these guys are still in Saudi Arabia in the equivalent of a Saudi witness protection program.
Right, and that's what I learned that some of your sources found out. I don't know.
Yeah, when I was in Morocco looking for Walid, what I did learn was that, contrary to the BBC report, he appears not to have flown for Royal Air Maroc. But when I talked to the Saudi airline, they were... Well, I got passed up the hierarchy a little bit, and then the final guy I talked to there sounded like he knew a lot more than he was ever going to let on, and he almost, you know, pretty much just came right out and said that. So my sense is that he was somehow linked up with Saudi Airlines over there in Morocco, and then he quickly repatriated after he popped up and waved and said hello to the BBC.
Well, that piqued my interest, and I actually did a little research on it, and... what I found was several Arab news stories about Walid saying that he was alive gave the true identification of him as a member of the Sakhali al-Sheri family, whose father, Muhammad Sakhali al-Sheri, and sometimes it's pronounced, I suppose, or transliterated more like Muhammad Ali Askali al-Sheri, but it's the same guy. And we have sources in the Arab press, such as Arab News, Al-Watan, and Al-Quds, who say that this guy actually was a member of a very prominent family who built a mosque in Khamis, I'm not sure how to pronounce this, Khamis Mushait, which was right next to Abha, the largest town in the Asir province. From which there was an article by a woman named Carolyn Lamb who said that there were six from Abha, but actually I looked a little further and it appears that there's actually nine. One of the al-Sheris that's not mentioned too often, his name is Fayez Bani Hamad. Well, they changed his name in the, I don't know how they got away with this, but the government records changed his last name to Bani Hamad, but Fayez al-Sheri is only one letter away from an added Y from the name Fayez al-Sheri, who was a general and the logistical director of the entire Kingdom of Saudi Arabia's armed forces. That's the uncle of these two boys, Walid and Wa'il.
So it sounds like they're from a powerful family in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
The speculation, you know, that I've heard, and it sounds sensible to me, would be that these guys were more or less on loan to U.S. intelligence from Saudi intelligence when they were over here taking these, pretending that, you know, going through the motions of these flight lessons.
Exactly. And, by the way, they also, the father was a building contractor who was connected with none other than Mohammed bin Laden, the patriarch of the bin Laden family, Osama bin Laden's
world.
Father, right.
And of course,
and the second most, you know, powerful and wealthy family in the kingdom, aside from the royal family.
And indeed, they're known as the Saudi face of the Army Corps of Engineers, bin Laden construction.
Yeah, I guess you could say that.
Well, that's what they're called, because they actually work with the Army Corps of Engineers. You know, Saudi Arabia was completely developed by this U.S. imperial money and, you know, governmental quote-unquote assistance, or some would call it colonialism, and the bin Laden family is really quite literally the Saudi face of the Army Corps of Engineers.
Many
people in the 9/11 Truth Movement don't realize, though, is that this doesn't necessarily implicate the Saudi government per se in 9/11, much less Saudi society, and it, you know, but the Saudi government is not particularly religious. They're actually very worried about the so-called religious extremists and, you know, the vast majority of their people who are religious and who think they're a bunch of corrupt despots, which they are. So it's conceivable that the Saudi government would more or less, you know, not really fully knowingly lend a bunch of patsies to the CIA and then protect them.
Exactly. And I think that there was speculation that the only way we're ever going to get this story out, or, you know, find out the rest of the story about these patsies, you know, their identities stolen, and probably in a very economical, efficient way, because they were all situated in this sort of desolate, remote part of Saudi Arabia around Abha in the Yasir province, which is the far southwestern extreme of the country. The only way we're going to get that is if there's a breakdown, a serious breakdown in the economy of the United States, and then there's a breakdown between relations of Saudi Arabia and the United States, because we'll no longer be able to protect them.
And that's actually exactly what I heard secondhand from somebody who claims to know someone high up in Saudi Arabia, that we won't learn anything more about these alleged hijackers unless there's a breakdown in relations between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia.
Interesting.
Well, we've learned quite a lot already, much of it thanks to Jay Kolar, my guest. We'll be back for more conversation with Jay and possibly with callers in a moment, so stay tuned. Okay, this is Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett, and I'm enjoying my new time slot. 2 to 4 p.m. Central Time, Saturdays and Sundays, right here on We the People Radio Network. I'm celebrating my inaugural weekend, warming up for Alex Jones, who's going to come on at the end of this show, by having on some of the best scholars in the 9/11 truth movement. Earlier today, we spoke with David Ray Griffin, and right now, we're discussing the hijackers, what we know about the alleged 9/11 hijackers, with Jay Kolar, the author of an article by the same name in the new paperback edition of Paul Taremka's volume, The Hidden History of 9/11. And, Jay, when I was in Morocco looking for Waleed Ashari, I did contact the U.S. Embassy in Rabat, and they said that nobody who worked there at the time, this was just last year, had heard of him because they rotate their personnel every couple of years. So that was, of course, the story had been that Waleed Ashari went to the U.S. Embassy in Rabat and told them that he was still alive. He was not a suicide hijacker. Here he was, and so on. And he said he worked for Royal Air Maroc, which turned out perhaps not to be true. At least Royal Air Maroc has always denied it. And in any case, you've discovered a bit of a Moroccan connection to 9/11, which was the headline of a newspaper article about my visit to Morocco in a leading Moroccan news magazine. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about that Moroccan connection.
Yes, well, when you mentioned that Waleed, when you searched for Waleed in May 2007, you found that the Moroccan authorities and journalists were afraid to examine Waleed's case and quote-unquote, because the reverberations might lead too close to home. And I was wondering what would those reverberations be. And then the very next month, Daniel Hopsticker, an excellent journalist, investigator, probably the best one there is in Florida, in June of 2007, the very next month, Hopsticker discovered incorporation papers filed in Florida on April 5th, 2001, listing, that's a few months before 9/11, listing a man named Hassan Eroudani, who had close ties to the Moroccan embassy in Washington, and he was listed as the business partner of none other than Mohamed Atta, the president of the company at that time. But then he was demoted later, I guess, to keep him a little more, you know, undercover. But he was the president of the company known as Karam LLC. And then, Hopsicker went right to it and politely questioned this guy by phone and asked him about his partnership, in which to reply, Eroudani angrily answered, quote, "I don't have anything to say about that," and slammed the phone on the receiver. So Hopsicker then reported that in Florida, records that would date from June 30th, 2000, they show that there's a Colonel Ahmed Arara, the military attaché of the Moroccan embassy, who incorporated a company called Titim, that's T-I-T-I-M, Holding. And the word, incidentally, Titim, in the Gaelic, it means falling down. So essentially, the company Falling Down Incorporated was, he incorporated with a terrorist suspect named Mohamed Arara, who's listed as...
like a good company name for fall guys.
Well, I was thinking, but I was thinking of the buildings falling down, too.
Well, that, too, I guess.
Yeah. He incorporated with terror suspect Mohammed Arara, who listed his address as the same as the colonel. And then we find out there's a photograph of Morocco's prime minister meeting with then-Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld in the Pentagon, this is 2000 now, with Colonel Arara, defense attaché, seated in the background. So, I mean, these linkages of Moroccan embassy personnel, and then they have nefarious business connections to Mohamed Atta and other terror suspects, might be the too close to home to which you your sources were referring.
Well, that's
pretty interesting. Why we haven't heard from Walid al-Sheri.
Right.
Also, part of this Titan Holdings was a man named Pascal Schreier. Now, he's the one that was a CIA agent because we know this because he had his best friend, witnesses in Venice testify, was a man named Wolfgang Boringer, or Wolfgang. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with the story. Wolfgang was called brother by Mohammed Atta. The Atta didn't even call his Arab friend brother. But, and you know, this is the part of the story where this whole story of the hijackers becomes a kind of a diversion from all their handlers, most of whom were of German extraction. They all spoke German. They were either from Switzerland, Germany, or Austria. And this guy had a hangar and a flight school he owned in Florida, along with, what's his name, Arnie Krutoff, who is the flight school owner, also a CIA, you could call, cutout, along with the other CIA cutout, two Dutchmen. Arnie
Rudy Deckers was the other one.
Yeah, Rudy Deckers.
Yeah, and Magic Dutch Boys.
Right, and Pascal Schreier owned another business along with Rudy Deckers. Now, this gets really interesting. I mean, there's so many. I mean, there's no such thing as 6 degrees of separation from any of these guys. Rudy Deckers, it turns out, his Huffman Aviation had been doing business with Carib Air. And Carib Air was owned by this guy named Dietrich Reinhardt, another German, who was into the business of basically of drug trafficking. And Dietrich must have been connected. All these guys lived basically in that area and the area of Charlotte County Airport. Hopsicker reported another problem they had there was 23 helicopters all of a sudden disappeared. And this guy
named common pattern with these big, these big ugly covert operations often seem to be linked to theft. Criminal rings that steal weapons and stuff from military bases. We see that with the JFK assassination, with the Jack Ruby's ring that was stealing weapons and selling them. Likewise, with the Martin Luther King assassination, people involved in that were armed thieves. And so, once again, we see that same pattern here.
Yeah, gypsies, tramps, and thieves. This Dietrich Reinhardt also. He owned the business, had the hangar, and right next door, the hangar owned, the owner was Sandra Hamuda, who was Pascal Schreier's wife. Well, she still is. She owns the hangar next door in Charlotte County Airport. So here's a good quote from Sybil Edmonds. Quote, "You have a network of people who obtain certain information and they take it out and sell it to whomever would be the highest bidder. Then you have people who would be bringing into the country narcotics from the East and their connections. It's only then that you really see the big picture. The post 9/11 intelligence failures included the willful quashing by the government of investigations tracing these criminal networks." And that's a quote from Sybil Edmonds, former FBI translator, who, of course, as we know, she's been forbidden to talk. She had the gag order put on her by Attorney General Ashcroft.
Right, but she still did manage to get out the information that 9/11 was financed, at least in part, by Richard Perle and Douglas Seitz through the American Azerbaijan Council and the American Turkish Council, which are front groups for arms and drug smuggling criminal syndicates.
So many
syndicates need to be cracked down on a little bit.
Yes. Well, anyway, Reinhardt was finally accused of allowing his planes to be used to ship drugs and worth billions of dollars in this country. That was during the Iran-Contra gate of the 1980s. And then you have federal prosecutors finally seizing his company, the aircraft, in the early 90s. And then you have the whole connection coming up once again between Rudy Deckers, the CIA cutout, who basically was keeping track of all these guys that showed up at his Huffman Aviation. Most of them were there, and the other few, including Ziad Jarrah, who we should talk about, showed up in the one next door.
Yeah, we should talk about Ziad Jarrah and his double. That's another of the amazing tales in your article.
Okay.
This is Kevin Barrett. I'm talking with Jay Kolar, author of What We Now Know About the Alleged 9/11 Hijackers in the Hidden History of 9/11. We'll be right back.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
To Truth Jihad Radio, right here on We the People Radio Network. I'm Kevin Barrett, talking with Jay Kolar, contributor to the brand new paperback edition of The Hidden History of 9/11. Very, very important book, and his article is about what we now know about the alleged 9/11 hijackers. Well, we do have a caller. It's Dave from California. Come in, Dave. How are you?
Hi, guys. Can you hear me?
Sure can.
Okay, good deal. Interesting. Two interesting guests today, Kevin. Good show as usual. I've got a little piece of information that almost none of the 9/11 truthers ever talks about, and I think it kind of got lost back in the day. But it's interesting. I was a fireman, and so I was really interested in anything that had anything to do with the rescuers. And I believe it was prior to 1995, or shortly thereafter, the news began occasionally publishing these claims that the fingerprint of Al-Qaeda was all over these multiple bombings where a bomb would go off and then they'd kill the rescuers after they showed up. Do you guys remember any of that? Because I do.
Oh, vaguely.
Yeah, well, anyway, basically it was like, this is Al-Qaeda's signature, you know.
Are you talking in relationship to the Oklahoma City bombing?
No. Well, basically it was in relationship to all multiple bombings where rescuers were taken out. It was kind of like they were laying groundwork. I've never heard it talked about, but I remember it very clearly. And I even went to a big rescue training thing once, and one of the classes that I attended was one on terrorism, and that was brought up as one of the main points that terrorists now like to go after the rescuers as well. So anyway, I just thought I'd let you guys know that if you run across it, it might fit into a little hole in the puzzle.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave, for that comment. I appreciate it. Take care.
Okay, see you guys later.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Yeah. I don't really refer too much to the hijackers in my chapter.
No, that's true, yeah. It's just, well, I guess the connection would be the demonization of so-called Al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
And, of course, in the way that demonization was constructed through the framing of these 19 patsies, is quite a contrast, you know, between what we're told and what it turns out to be the reality here.
In writing this chapter, I tried to show that I didn't want to give people the misleading impression that this was the hijackers actually did what they said they did.
Well, no, I certainly didn't draw that conclusion.
When I talk about them, it's always the alleged hijackers. They're really patsies. But until I finished my case, I wouldn't call them patsies. But now I think we could call them, safely say that they were patsies, and things that they weren't able to do or are unwilling to do or that would be done then by people that would replace them, called, what I call doubles in my chapter. And there's even a little bit of a misunderstanding, I think. Nafiz in our book, I slightly disagree with him. Nafiz Ackman, he writes the chapter about state terrorism, you know, a false flag operation, in which he kind of misrepresents my concept that doubles were being used in a U.S. covert intelligence operation in order essentially to defame at least 10 of these guys and who were turned up, you know, alive later, and to frame them all and to defame Islam, indeed, by showing that they had connections to terrorism. So Ackman's statements that we are forced to conclude that at least 10 of the hijackers identified, including those now reported alive, they had observed prior to 9/11, were doubles using false identities that did not actually belong to them. Well, that's kind of confusing. And one might get the wrong impression that the unidentified doubles then were the real hijackers who went down with the planes.
And of course, they would have been fanatical Muslims.
Identity, but I'm saying that the agency which stole the identities, or in some cases created composite identities, which still had Arab faces, was in fact the CIA, FBI, U.S. covert intelligence operatives, which had as their goal to divert us from the real insider perpetrators of 9/11, who likely, most likely used some kind of remote control flown aircraft.
Well, that's what Paul Grimke also thinks. Actually, of course, it would have to be remote control. If you rig up the building for demolition, you're not going to trust somebody, especially somebody who can't fly a Cessna, you know, to hit that building on the first shot and give it an excuse to fall down.
Right.
So, yeah, obviously, you'd have to make sure that that crash into the building would happen.
Exactly. So what I stated in my chapter was that if you're going to look at these guys as patsies, it was somewhat akin to the guy that had multiple doubles, Lee Harvey Oswald, in the Kennedy assassination. So I would call them like a squadron of Lee Harvey Oswalds. And then I stated that probably the winner of the Lee Harvey Oswald double or doubles award would be, in my opinion, Zia Jarrah. I gave several pieces of evidence, which I could just summarize now if you like.
Yeah, sure. So I'd like to hear more about Jarrah.
That it showed that there, after a certain period in time where I think it was a July 25th, I think, in 2001, Jarrah had decided to leave, apparently for good, because he bought a one-way ticket from Miami to Dusseldorf, something he'd never done before, and then there to join his fiancée, Sengun, Aysel Sengun, who is Turkish, and by no means a fundamentalist, a Muslim at all. And from that date on, Jarrah was literally not Jarrah in Florida. There's increasing signs of the insertion, at least one double. Somehow he was persuaded to return the following month, and I would think that the handlers had to have him back close by in order to liquidate him, because otherwise the story wouldn't stick at all. And then, so they might have, I was hypothesizing that they probably made him an offer that they're going to make sure that he get a Class 1 or, you know, a Boeing 747 pilot's license, which would be kind of difficult for him, because the only thing bad that anybody really had to say about him was that he was a lousy pilot. He was a very friendly guy. You know, we interviewed, there were interviews from friends, classmates, instructors, family, landlords, you name it, that said he was more of a jet setter than a jet pilot. And he was apolitical, he was non-religious, he was well-liked, he was outgoing, he was friendly, and he loved to party. So he would fit in with this group of people. He also, at an early age, you know, showed an affinity for flying planes. And so I give this several examples of the doubles. One is that the probable sign of a double's presence in Venice, there was a second residence existed for Jarrah, at which he never stayed while attending flight school there, which was interesting. And then number two, while the real Jarrah never signed his name as Jarrahi, that's J-A-R-R-A-H with an I at the end, There was another lookalike double in Brooklyn, which occurred in 1995. Well, the landlord there said that after he saw the picture of Zia Jera as one of the alleged hijackers, which was distributed by the FBI in the United States on September 27, 2001, that the landlord came forth and said, yeah, that's the guy. He was a photographer, and he frequently had prostitutes. Well, at that time, Zia Jera was still in high school, a Catholic high school in Beirut, Lebanon. And he would be home every weekend with his parents, so I don't think that was the same guy.
Well, you know, some people would argue that that might not be a double. It could be a coincidence, mistaken identity, or what have you.
That's true. But then this Jerahi, quote-unquote, with the I at the end, that surname can't really be explained away just as coincidence because it reappears, you know, inexplicably at about the same time that he has... He never really got along with Atta, but they had a, you know, parting away when he did take that one-way ticket out. And, well, that was actually the month before, June 2001. Jerahi Ziad appears on the German passport of a man accompanied by a totally different-looking Al Hasnaoui. I don't know if you've seen the different photographs that the FBI has posted. If they're on the internet under the Moussaoui trial document.
I believe they're in the book too, aren't they?
In our book?
Aren't they? Or?
Well, we have I was able to get the collage in of just Jera, but not his accompanying Al Hasnaoui.
Oh, right.
Yeah, but anyway, that's in a different one.
Okay, yeah, it's a pretty interesting and very strong case that there were doubles operating to help frame these 9/11 pasties. We'll be back for some more conversation in just a moment. Stick around.
News, politics, cover-ups, government corruption. You're listening to We the People Radio Network.
WTPRN.
To Truth Jihad Radio, right here on We the People Radio Network. Warming up for Alex Jones here on a Sunday afternoon, talking with Jay Kolar, author of What We Now Know About the Alleged 9/11 Hijackers. And we do have a caller. It's Wyatt from Maryland. Hello, Wyatt.
Hello, how are you?
All right, how are you doing?
Good, good. Interesting guest that you have there. Of course, listening to it, I'm listening to it on my phone. All the myriad of names begins to not play any part in any of my recall. Unfortunately, it's just so many Arab names. It was just it's a little hard to follow. But I understand.
Well, that's how they were able to pull this off. The people that framed these pasties were the Keystone Cops, as far as I can tell. They did it so badly. But they're getting away with it because, you know, to a lot of Americans, all Arabs look alike and their names sound alike.
All their names start with Al.
Yeah, yeah. let me tell you a little story. I'll make it quick. That happened to me in 2000. I started with a company at Baltimore Washington International Airport, and it was a sedan limousine service. And in March of 2000, I had a walk-up. That means somebody walked up to me. It wasn't a reservation. And he was Arab-looking. And he resembled, I'll tell you who he resembled. The 19 pictures that the FBI put out, that one of the guys was from Morocco. He strongly... when I saw that at first in 2001 or 2002, when he kept showing it, I said, boy, that guy looks familiar. And he was from Morocco. And I believe, to the best of my recollection, that I picked that man up because he was the one that came to my sedan for a ride. And I tried to make conversation with people as we're driving. So I was taking from Baltimore, Washington Airport to Dover Air Force Base. That's where he was going. And in our conversation, I found out that he was from Morocco, and he was in a flight school in Florida. He didn't. I can't recall which one, but he may have told me that he was going for his commercial pilot's license, and he was going to fly for airlines in Morocco. And he strongly resembled the Moroccan that the picture is from the list of pictures that the FBI put out.
Let's ask Jay. I'm drawing a blank on this. I know Walid Ashari supposedly was living in Morocco and flying there, but he was from Saudi Arabia.
That's correct, yeah. Do you mean Walid Ashari by any chance?
I really don't know. I don't have the picture in front of me.
Did he have a very full kind of fattish face?
Yes, that's him.
And yes, maybe yeah, his head was leaning to the left or something, or to the right in the photograph?
I can't remember exactly how he was leaning, but he had a rounded, full face.
Well, this would be actually, he had left the United States in 2000, and that's the last time he was here. So actual Walid Ashari, he had studied flight training here. He got his degree at Embry-Riddle University.
That was it. That's where he went, Embry-Riddle. That's correct. I remember now as soon as you said it.
Yeah. And I prove in my chapter that he could not have flown that plane because he was still alive after 9/11. And
one final thing, I took him to Dover Air Force Base, and he took a military flight home. Now, how in the world, what connection does anyone have to go to take a military flight home unless there is a connection?
His family had a lot of juice, as they say. His uncle was the logistical director of Saudi Arabia's armed forces.
Mm-hmm.
His uncle was. And so, well, and you know, his father.
That could be it, then. Yeah.
His father was connected with the.
Pretty spooky-looky, as my friend Michael Andrake puts it.
Yeah, that could be the case, then, that family connections in the military.
Yeah. That was it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, we have to talk some more about him, actually.
Go ahead, Jay. Let's tell us some more about Walid Ashari. He's also a person of interest to me since I went after him in Morocco and came up empty.
Well, I thought since we already mentioned his connections, we might move on to somebody else like Zia Jarrah and then Salem El-Hazmi. Both of whom have stunning, very interesting stories. I started to talk about the doubles as they're typically used in covert intelligence operations. That's like the signature for it. The handlers substitute doubles when patsies become uncooperative. And so given the stakes, when they could no longer rely on Jarrah, which, you know, when he took off on his one-way trip away, they had to use doubles, and I started to talk about how all of a sudden the doubles that appear were, if you look at the very first page, the title page of the part one, Hijackers, Who Were They? I have a collage of Zia Jarrah in which we show his Lebanese passport photo, his Jarrah when he was in that video, which is alleged last will and testament video with Atta from January 18, 2000, which I showed was forged for numerous reasons. And then there's a photograph of him in Paris with his fiance. And then we have two really strange photographs. One is, I call them double number one or imposter number one, which is actually the U.S. multiple entry visa photo. And that's the one that you see, the surviving singed one-third of the way on his, the upper right-hand side of the photograph, which was in the obliterated UA-93 crash is what our government alleges.
Right.
But it's kind of difficult to believe that when there's not a spot of blood on it, and then, you know, on the entire piece, not just the photograph, but the entire piece of, which was crinkled and crumpled. Anybody could have taken a match and done that.
Right, and the picture doesn't even look like him.
No, it's not him, actually. And when you see the original U.S. visa from the government office, it's his face is wide. He looks like a wide-faced Tom Jones. You know, his hair is kind of black.
Unusual.
It looks like it's kinky. Pardon?
Not unusual, right.
Not unusual. And his eyelids are very thin and kind of sullen, droopy look. It's like he, you know, kind of frog lids. I don't know. And then, well, this photo was actually taken, and visually you could see it was altered, visibly altered by somebody. It must have been somebody in the government. Because when it turns up in the Musawi trial exhibit, MM00196, with a photocopy of the first duplicate of his driver's license, which is this imposter, you know, number two, who looks like, many people said, an African-American because it's such a dark, dark photograph. Well, I had to lighten it up and to actually see who that was, and there's no resemblance at all between those two and the real Zia Jera. And yet here they are in government exhibit, the number I just gave you, where they're paired together by the FBI. Now, the FBI did another pairing of the same altered visa photograph, which horizontally compresses his head to make it look more like the thinner-headed Zia Jera, the real Zia Jera, and makes his eyes look more hopeful or optimistic, whereas the other guy is just very depressive and sullen-looking.
Yeah, what's with these guys that they keep taking these thin-faced patsies like Zia Jera
right.
and Osama bin Laden and replacing them with very, very wide-faced imposter doubles like Fatty bin Laden or this character who was standing in for Zia Jera?
Well, as I said in my chapter, especially the Osama bin Laden video, which was a hoax, that guy could never have been the same bin Laden, especially since he named the names of hijackers, I think 6 of 9 of whom later showed up alive. Why would he name, you know, hijackers who weren't really hijackers? That would be very embarrassing to himself and to the whole alleged al-Qaeda phenomenon. But it was only to last long enough for the American public to see it and be shocked. And only, you know, months later would researchers do the research and be able to challenge the story. And then, again, the press was very hesitant at accepting it. So that was just a commercial, which nobody would suspect until later you find out the true story, and it's too late. The American public has been brainwashed.
Well, that's kind of how this whole thing works. They wallop you with a psyop, and by the time you figure it out, people have been brainwashed, and they've got their wars, they've been burning the Constitution, and so on and so forth. But we're going to have to turn it around by getting to the truth, and I thank you, Jay Kolar, for your great work in this article in the Hidden History of 9/11, which people can now find in the improved and cheapened paperback edition. Well, hey, it's been great, Jay. Thank you for coming on, and
well, thank
good
you.
Luck
My
with
pleasure,
future endeavors.
Kevin.
Okay, take care.
All right.
Bye-bye. All right, that was Jay Kolar. We have plenty of other great radio guests coming up in the not-too-distant future. Tomorrow, Mark Gaffney will be coming on my show on the Evil Rival Network, GCN. He's the author of The 9/11 Mystery Plane and The Vanishing of America, brand-new book coming out in a month or two. So until then, see y'all later.
The Bill of Rights protects every American's God-given right to keep and bear arms. Now that right is being seriously undermined as legally registered rifles are being confiscated in some parts of our country. If we're not careful, we may find ourselves with no right to own guns. And that's where Gun Owners of America comes in. Gun Owners of America is in Washington every day fighting for you to keep that right. Congressman Ron Paul has called GOA the only no-compromise gun lobby in Washington. You need to be part of this great grassroots group of activists who are keeping the heat on their members of Congress. Find out right now how you can join. Call 888-886-GUNS and get started receiving their fact-filled newsletters and action alerts. Call 888-886-GUNS or go to their webpage at gunowners.org and help make your voice heard in Washington. Make that call right now and call Gun Owners of America at 888-886-GUNS. Remember, it's not just about gun control, it's about control.
Giving the power back. back to the people. You're listening to We the People Radio Network.